The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Today, James Rickards.
Our conversation with Jim, well, who is he? An investment banker, a risk manager, a lawyer. I mean, if you look at his CV, it's a fascinating mix of experience in the capital markets, a negotiation with long-term capital management as it was in the midst of being dissolved, how it was going to be bailed out and who was going to be involved, who was going to pick up what weight. He's done a variety of things, advising the Department of Defense and U.S. intelligence communities. He's constantly talking with hedge funds from around the world, and it was very interesting. Back in 2009, he served as a facilitator for the first ever financial war games.
This was in Virginia.
Conducted by the Pentagon. So, I mean, obviously, you've probably seen him, heard of him on CNBC, CNN, Fox, C-SPAN, those kinds of things, but also lectures at Johns Hopkins. Anyways, we could go on and on and on. I think what I like, and you'll find this with many of our guests, is they tend to be good lateral thinkers from one category to another, from one field of endeavor to another. The fact that he has a legal background means almost nothing except that it's just a part of who Jim is. The fact that he has capital markets experience, 30 plus years, it doesn't define him. It's just a part of what he brings to the table. And there is a lot that he brings to the table. It's one of the reasons why, and on occasion, there are books that I consider non-negotiable reads. So, I mean, I tend to buy them by the case, and in certain instances require that they're read by as many people as possible. This is a book you must read. I've read it three times, and I think you'll see quite clearly why and how we are today on a knife's edge between depression and hyperinflation.
You know, David, you had the office read this book, and of course, when we read the books, we also write reports. We come at it from our own view, and then we gather, we discuss. I mean, you buy everybody pizza, and we take hours to discuss the book. But I'll tell you, this one in particular had so many elements, we could have done this over and over and over. I mean, he talks about complexity. He talks about the financial markets. He understands currency wars. But you know what I think he really understands most? The value of real solid currency and probably the return to that currency. But in the meantime, Dave, there are ways to fight wars. And we're seeing Japan right now. They declared a currency war with their own yen just recently, but we've been seeing currency wars creep up really for the last 2 or 3 years.
It was Martin Van Creveld who opened the idea to military strategists that the nature of warfare was forever changing. And he suggested that we would have low-intensity conflict becoming more of the norm. What Jim Rickards brings to this is something that I think, whether it's the professional soldier or the student of history, and certainly the market practitioner, will appreciate. Again, that there is something to be understood here. Financial and monetary destabilization, which is, again, like that low-intensity conflict, deliberately orchestrated with domination, with displacement, with defeat, similar objectives, but again, sort of outside that classic notion of armed conflict. And the idea of currency war certainly goes back in history. Jim, you point out that there's two other instances of such conflict in the last 100 years, 1921 to 36 and 67 to 87. Starting in 2010, we started to hear a lot more of that language. Brazilian Finance Minister Guido Mantega described it as an international currency war, which had already broken out. And, you know, this is the challenge, I think, for many of our listeners. Without a body count, without the physical destruction of war, I'm sure people might appreciate clarification. What is a currency war? What are the inherent dangers? I know it's your contention that this is the third currency war in the last 100 years. How do these conflicts tend to be resolved?
Well, you've actually touched on two very important vectors, and let me kind of separate them, but they do come together. One is the idea of asymmetric warfare, and the other one is the idea of currency wars. The first one is exactly right. This is a large area of strategic study right now, which is if you look at conventional military warfare, there is not a country in the world that can stand up to the United States, that can go toe-to-toe with the United States in terms of, you know, kinetic warfare, kinetic meaning things that shoot or explode. So our Navy can sink any other Navy, our air power can suppress any other Air Force, our other aspects of our military can just dominate any theater, not without loss Well, casually, of course, but no one can really come close to us in that. As a result of that, our rivals of the United States, starting with Russia and China, but also Iran and others, are working on what are called asymmetric warfare tactics. What would those be? Well, some of them are obvious, you know, biological warfare, chemical warfare. We're seeing some of that in Syria today. Cyber warfare, of course, that's going on all over the world. But one of the new fields is financial war, where you would actually try to disable or disadvantage your enemy or reduce their capacity by fighting in financial space using stocks, bonds, derivatives, commodities, et cetera, to actually to wage war. So that's one large field of study, and I think that we're going to be hearing more about that in the future. And I do talk about that in my book. In the first two chapters, we describe the first ever financial war game conducted by the Pentagon. This was conducted in 2009. At a top secret weapons laboratory outside of Washington, D.C., by the Office of the Secretary of Defense. But there were many other components of the U.S. government, intelligence community, Federal Reserve Treasury, who were present, as well as outside experts, myself included, and some folks that I recruited from Wall Street. And we spent 2 days doing this, and we had the usual teams. So there was a Russia team, a China team, but we also had a team that wasn't a country. It was sort of hedge funds and Swiss banks, U.S. team, et cetera. And then it played out over a couple of days. But the rules were you could only use financial weapons. But I was on the China team, and we worked with the Russia team to develop a gold-backed currency and said, you know, starting now, anybody who wanted to buy Russian energy exports or Chinese manufactured exports had to use this particular gold-backed currency. So I'll leave it to the readers. I hope they enjoy that. But that's described in a lot of detail. But apart from an individual war game, this is a growing field of study and engagement, and will be an important part of the battle space in the future. Now, the second thing you touched on are what I'll call the currency wars. These are more economic than military. They are fought out in the global macroeconomic space, but this is more conventional economic competition among countries. You're not really trying to fight a war. What you're trying to do is, you know, grow your economy, but you do it by cheapening your currency and steal growth from your neighbors. This is the kind of thing that's been going on for centuries, and I do point to two currency wars that you mentioned, one in the 1920s, one in the 1970s. But the currency war is the topic of the book, but the book really covers both the military aspect and the economic or financial aspect.
You know, these conflicts are obviously, they have an international context, but the purposes served are largely domestic. When you're facing declining growth, high unemployment, banking sector weakness, fiscal issues, these are things that you mention in your book. And again, if you imagine a pie, as that pie shrinks, that pie being global GDP, there's greater competition to maintain the old slice, if you will. Nobody wants to see that happen. And this is where those policies, beggar the neighbor policies of the 1930s emerged, was in competition for what was, in a context that was changing for the worse. And so it is these domestic issues that are driving international conflict. You describe sort of three different theaters. Maybe you want to explore what those theaters look like.
Sure, David. And I think you're right. You make a very important point that the currency wars are fought globally, but they are caused by domestic considerations. The main domestic driver in the U.S. right now is insufficient growth, either nominal growth or real growth, for that matter. And so one of the ways to stimulate growth, we try to, of course, these are all forms of market manipulation, but the Fed always took the view that they could cut rates, lower interest rates would stimulate borrowing, consumption, investment, kind of get the economy moving again. The problem, of course, is that in 2008, they got down to zero and they couldn't cut anymore. So the question is, the policy question is, well, how do you stimulate the economy if you're the Fed, if you can't cut rates any further because you're already at zero? And the answer is you can cheapen the currency. Well, how does cheapening the currency cause inflation? A lot of people think that cheapening the currency is a way to promote exports, and it can have some effects in the export sector. You know, if the dollar gets cheaper and you're Indonesia and you have to buy an airplane, and you're looking at Airbus versus Boeing, you know, maybe a cheaper dollar causes you to give the order to Boeing. That creates some exports and creates some jobs. So you do have those effects, but that's not the main reason the Fed is doing it. The main reason they're doing it is to import inflation. You know, the U.S. is not just an exporter. We're a large importer. In fact, we import more than we export. And so when you cheapen the currency, what happens is your import prices go up. That creates inflation in the supply chain, which, you know, increases nominal GDP, if nothing else. But what the Fed really hopes is that because of the inflation, that'll cause people to spend more money, that'll increase velocity, that'll you know, kind of feed on itself and become self-sustaining and grow the economy. Now, it hasn't worked at all. I'm explaining what the Fed's trying to do, but I think it's important to point out that it's actually not working, partly because people are so shocked by what happened in 2008. They're hanging on to the money. We're clearly in a liquidity trap. But I like to say, if you want something and you don't get it, try harder. And that's what we've seen with the Fed, with first cutting rates, then QE1, QE2, QE3, nominal GDP targeting, Operation Twist, forward guidance, currency wars, communication policy. The Fed has tried every trick in the book to get this economy moving, and it hasn't worked, and it won't work at the end of the day. But they're going to keep trying, so I would expect that we'll see a lot more money printing before all is said and done. So that's really how the genesis, if you will, of the currency wars. It's an effort by countries to cheapen their currencies, not so much to promote exports, but to import inflation and drive GDP.
Yeah, this is in the context of an incredibly complex system. We still have the dangers of 2008. Some would argue that they're future dangers. Some would argue that they're very much present dangers, but they're certainly not past tense. On your recommendation, I've been reading Tanger's book on the collapse of complex societies. Maybe you can sort of tie in the idea of complexity to the issues we inevitably face in our financial and monetary sphere.
Sure, David. I think it's a very good question. A lot of people... people throw the word complexity around sort of as an all-purpose descriptor of the fact that things are kind of hard to figure out. But they sort of use complexity and complication interchangeably. But that's not technically correct. Something can be complicated but not necessarily be complex. For example, my watch is complicated. If you take the battery off my watch, you'll see, springs and gears and jewels and all kinds of parts. It's very complicated, but it's not complex. A complex system actually has certain properties that go way beyond complication. One of them are the ability to throw up what are called emergent properties. Emergent properties are things that just seem to come out of nowhere, maybe in financial markets. People call them black swans, but, black swan's a nice metaphor, but in fact, there's a lot of science behind it. So what Tanger did is he looked at the collapses of civilization through the millennia. And, of course, everyone sort of has a little bit of familiarity with the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and that's one that's held up as an example of collapse, and indeed it is. But there are many others. There was the collapse of the numerous Bronze Age civilizations around 1100 BC, and a lot of smaller civilizations, some that many people have never heard of, have collapsed here and there, and he studied them. And people like to say, well, gee, what caused the collapse of the civilization? And they look at specific causes, and they say, well, this one had a drought, or this one was invaded by barbarians, or this one had a disease, et cetera. This one had an earthquake, and the physical infrastructure was destroyed. And invariably, those things happen. But what Tanger pointed out was that civilizations that fell to barbarians have had barbarian invasions before, and civilizations that collapsed due to an earthquake have had earthquakes before. In other words, those causes that historians point to have happened many times before, and the civilization had withstood them. But suddenly it happens, and they couldn't withstand them. So he was looking at deeper causes. He said, you fended off, Rome's a good example. They fended off barbarian invasions for centuries, and then one day they couldn't do it anymore. The barbarians came in and destroyed the empire. So why was it different? What was different? What he discovered is that civilizations over time become more and more complex. Economies become complex, et cetera. And what you get are these elites. And elites, it can be a priesthood, it can be an aristocracy, it can be a king and his court, et cetera. And they become very extractive, and they take more and more wealth out of society. And eventually society kind of hollows out from the bottom up. In other words, everyday citizens get tired of supporting the elites because they require so much money and energy and taxation to support these complex societies. And they just give up. And then that's when, the earthquake comes and they don't rebuild, or the barbarians come and they don't resist, or the disease comes and they don't recover, et cetera. And so a lot of people imagine that, for example, when the barbarians invaded the Roman Empire, they had to fight their way all the way to Rome. That's not what happened. What happened was they invaded, and the farmers welcomed them. They said, hey, because the barbarians had a better tax policy. Barbarian tax policy was 10%, and they gave you protection, and they left you alone. The Roman taxes at the time were close to 20%, and they didn't leave you alone at all. And if you tried to get out of paying taxes by not growing crops, for example, they would tax you on the crops you could have grown, but for the fact that you didn't choose to. And so there was that oppressive taxation from the center, oppressive control, a parasite class of elites who extracted wealth and didn't produce anything of their own that caused the bottom rungs of society to just give up, and then the entire empire fell. So that's Taner's thesis. He has very good evidence to back it up. As applied to the United States today, you can see the same thing happening. Tax burdens are becoming intolerable, more and more regulations, more and more taxation. Who's benefiting from that? Well, it's the banking elite, the corporate elite, and the politicians. You know, you go to Washington, D.C., like, so unemployment in Illinois is 9% statewide. But in Washington, it's closer to 5%. Well, why is Washington doing so well? The answer is they're taking wealth from the rest of us and spending it on ourselves. So we have some of those symptoms of collapse. I'm not saying that the U.S. society is going to collapse tomorrow. What I'm saying is we're moving very dangerously in the direction of more and more complexity, more and more wealth extraction by the elites for their own benefit, and beginning to see some of the symptoms of a society in decline.
When what we also saw from 2008, and it exists today, is the consequence of deregulation from the derivatives market. You know, 10 years ago, the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, an increase in the use of leveraged derivatives and futures instruments by banks and hedge funds. And this brings more complexity into the system. And as you say, there's these opportunities for there to be emergent properties, issues that are sort of unforeseen, those black swans as a consequence. Now, tie into that, we today have the underlying physical markets being bullied and overwhelmed, whether it's the copper market, the oil market, the gold and silver market, these come to mind. How do, you know, again, going back to our original idea of this being a conflict, asymmetric warfare, currency wars, etc., how do these derivative products serve as a tool, leaving countries more vulnerable to outside attack? That's part number one to the question. Part number two would be, does this diminish the importance of fundamentals in those underlying physical markets?
Yeah, again, very good question, David. I think that, you know, that what you point to, the rise of derivatives, when the system collapses, and I do expect the international monetary system to collapse sometime, you know, sooner than later, meaning next 3, 4, 5 years. It's not a 10-year forecast, but it's not something that's necessarily going to happen tomorrow or next year. But in that kind of 3 to 5 year range, we have the makings of the collapse of the international monetary system. By the way, that's not meant to be a provocative statement. The international monetary system actually has collapsed 3 times in the past 100 years. It collapsed in 1914, again in 1939, and again in 1971. So it wouldn't be that unusual or unexpected for that to happen again. When it happens, by the way, it doesn't mean we all go to caves and eat baked beans. But what it means is that the major financial powers and trading powers sit down and they reform the system. They have to recut the deck, so to speak. And one of the interesting questions to me is, what will that future international monetary system look like? But coming back to the causes of the collapse, you know, often when you have a catastrophe, it's something where you had some warning. There was some reason to believe it was coming. We had our warning in 1998 with the collapse of long-term capital management and the global financial crisis at the time. That was, you know, it was 15 years ago. A lot of people have forgotten about it. Certainly the amounts involved seemed small compared to what happened in 2008. But it almost caused the complete closure of global markets. I mean, I was very involved in it myself. I actually negotiated the bailout of long-term capital management, so I have a very good working knowledge of what happened there. And we were literally hours away from the collapse of global markets. It was rescued at the last minute, and it didn't happen, so people sort of didn't pay attention to it. But, you know, just because we fell on the runways and landed the plane without a fire didn't mean that it wasn't very close to a catastrophe. So the lesson, the warning that came out of 1998 should have been reduce derivatives, reduce the interconnectedness, reduce the risk, et cetera. What did Congress and the president actually do? They did the opposite. They increased the risk. In 1999, we had the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which allowed banks to act like hedge funds. And then in 2000, we had the repeal of swaps regulation, which meant that not only could a bank be a hedge fund, but you could leverage yourself sky high through the use of swaps. Then in later on, in 2004, 2006, the SEC reduced the capital rules for broker-dealers. So instead of 15 to 1, which was the old maximum leverage, you could now go 30 to 1. Basel II came along and allowed banks to increase leverage. So here you are, you have this warning, this near disaster in 1998. The disaster is telling you to reduce risk and reduce derivatives. Instead, public policy does the opposite. They let banks become hedge funds. They let them do more derivatives. They increase the leverage across the board. So I could see the 2008 disaster coming a mile away. I was out in 2004, 2005, lecturing and writing about my experiences in 1998, warning that this collapse was coming. And when it came, it was completely unexpected. And I'll give you a very concrete example of the role of derivatives. When the subprime crisis started in 2007, there were a lot of smart people, a lot of commentators, think of Ben Stein in particular as an economist and a lawyer, who said, this is nothing to worry about. By the way, Bernanke said the same thing. And here was the analysis. There was about $1 trillion worth of subprime and what are called Alt-A or alternate mortgages that were sort of like subprime. So there were $1 trillion of those. Historically, default rates had been sort of 4%. 5% was considered extremely high as a default rate on the mortgage. So what the commentators said, well, let's assume a 20% default rate, which was outrageous. You know, it was way beyond historical experience. So we have $1 trillion of loans. A 20% default rate, which is very high, means $200 billion of losses. In real terms, it was not greater than the S&L crisis in the 1980s. So they said, okay, worst case, we have $200 billion of losses. That's a lot, but we can deal with it. The system will bounce back. What they missed is there may have been $1 trillion of mortgages, but there were $6 trillion of derivatives. So now apply the same 20% assumption to the $6 trillion of derivatives. You're looking at $1.2 trillion of losses, six or seven times the S&L crisis, and that's actually what happened. So the reason it was so severe and so catastrophic and so many firms failed and so many more firms would have failed but for the government intervention was because people were unaware of and underestimated the multiplier effect of derivatives on the underlying losses. Well, guess what? In 2008, everyone said, you know, these banks are too big to fail. That's a problem. Today, they're bigger. The five biggest banks in the United States are larger today than they were in 2008. They have a larger percentage of the total banking assets. They have larger derivatives books. They're more interconnected. So everything that led to the catastrophe in 2008, which shouldn't have happened because we should have learned our lessons in 1998, today is even bigger. So now we've had two warnings, 1998 and 2008. I think we've had our last warning. The next time it collapses, it'll be for good.
You know, to what degree then, I mean, here's the issue. We have command economy dynamics muting the market messaging system. I mean, this is really where the question emerges for me. To what degree has price discovery been damaged by Fed activism? You know, investors look at the markets today and arguably, as you say, too big to fail is now bigger. The derivatives market has not been tamed. There are risks as great as 2008, if not greater. And yet there's distortions in the marketplace, which would lead you to believe, and if you certainly hold to the efficient market hypothesis, there's nothing to worry about here, nothing at all. How do we approach the markets? Is the bond market telling us anything of relevance? The stock market telling us anything of relevance? In fact, the old litmus for stress and strain in the market, gold, it's going down in the context of this sort of quote-unquote risky environment.
Well, it's very hard to find a market that's sending out pure price signals these days, or a market that's not directly or indirectly manipulated by the Fed. And the reason is the Fed is engaged, obviously, in, they would call it policy, I call it manipulation, in fixed income markets. But the problem is they're manipulating the price of money. You know, what is the price of money? What's an interest rate? You know, high interest rate means money's expensive. A low interest rate means money's cheap or easy, as the case may be. Well, there's not a market in the world that's not denominated in some kind of money. Whether you go to gold or stocks or other commodities or any market you name, you put a dollar price on it. You know, we say Apple's $450 a share, or we say gold is $1,250 an ounce, you know, as the case may be. So when you're manipulating money, which the Fed is doing, you're manipulating all these other markets because they're denominated money or they involve exchanges for money. And the problem is the Fed is relying on markets to tell it what it's doing. But the markets themselves are distorted by the Fed's own actions. And so you create a feedback loop where you think you're pursuing policy over here, and you're looking at these other markets to tell you if you're doing a good job, but the other markets themselves are giving you distorted signals because they're affected by the first thing you're doing. And that's the recursive function of the feedback loop. So the Fed's drinking its own Kool-Aid right now. Now, having said that, markets are telling us a few things. You see the declining dollar price of gold. You know, we're all aware of it. It's, you know, reached a peak of about $1,900 an ounce in August 2011. Today, it's, as we speak, somewhere down around $1,250 an ounce. That's, you know, over a 30% decline, so a massive decline in the past almost 2 years. But what is that telling us? Well, what it's telling us is that the bigger concern is not inflation, but deflation. And the way I think about it you can hold the dollar constant and look at the price of gold go up or down and say gold's volatile or it's coming down, et cetera. What I prefer to do analytically is hold an ounce of gold as my constant, so call an ounce of gold my constant, and then see what's happening with the dollar. And when you see the dollar price of gold going up or down, the way I think of it is gold's constant. What's actually happening is the dollar's moving around, not the gold. And so today, with the dollar price of gold coming down very sharply in recent days, or recent months actually, what that tells me is that if gold's constant, then the dollar's getting stronger. Well, the Fed, think about it. The Fed wants a weaker dollar to create inflation, but they're getting a stronger dollar, which is deflationary. The Fed's actually getting the opposite of what it wants. It's a pretty scary thing when a central bank wants inflation and they can't get it. That shows you how powerful the deflation is, and that's what the price of gold is telling us. So if you're the Fed, you kind of have two choices. Do you want to just give up, you know, throw in the towel, say, okay, we've tried everything. You know, we printed $3 trillion. We talked a good game. We, tried to trash the dollar, gave forward guidance, you know, did all these things to create inflation, and it just didn't work, so we give up. That's one approach. Well, if they do that, forget it. I mean, asset prices are going to fall. I mean, gold will go down, but so will housing and stocks. You know, I like to tell people, you know, in that world, in the world where the Fed gives up and deflation takes over, you know, gold could go to, let's say, $800 an ounce. But the problem is the S&P will be at 800 also. In other words, nothing moves in isolation. Gold, if gold goes down in nominal dollars, it won't be alone. It'll be because we're on a massive deflationary vector and stocks are going to go down even more. In some ways, you might like $500 gold better than $5,000 gold. And the reason is that if gold goes to 5,000, I expect it will eventually, there are a lot of ways to make money, but if gold goes to 500, that's such a deflationary, depressionary world that gold might be the only way to preserve your wealth. In other words, the nominal price could be down, but the relative price, the real price, could be higher. You always have to think about things in nominal and real space. But I don't think the Fed's going to do that. I don't think they are going to throw in the towel. What they'll do is, as I say, try harder, particularly with Janet Yellen. If she is the next chairperson, then you would expect the Fed's balance sheet to go to $4 trillion, and they're getting close to that now, $5 trillion, $5.5 trillion, maybe $6 trillion. They're just going to keep printing until they bend the velocity curve and people start spending. At that point, inflation will take off, and the Fed thinks they can keep a lid on it. They'll find out that they can't. In other words, the Fed thinks that they can take inflation from 1% to 2% to 3% to 4%. If it gets a little hot, they can dial it back down again. But what they're going to discover is that it'll go to 4% and then it'll go to 9%. In other words, it'll spin out of control, which is exactly what happened in the 1970s. So, and that's the world where gold is very well. But we might be a year, a year and a half, even 2 years away from that. These things don't happen overnight.
Seeing inflation as a monetary issue, you have super or hyperinflation, which takes on more of a psychological or social dynamic, sociological dynamic. What do you see as sort of triggering a loss of confidence in paper currencies? That's part one. And part two, we had an interesting conversation with Guido Garodio a number of years ago dealing with the international monetary system, the history, the role that gold has played. And I know that at some point in the future, you see gold re-emerging as a part of the monetary system. How does that happen? So again, part one, what triggers a loss of confidence in paper currencies? And is that the circumstance that then opens up gold reemerging as, or being remonetized to some degree?
Yeah, I think it triggers as not a very important question or thing to think about, actually trivial. And let me explain why. Because what's important is not the trigger, but the instability of the system. And the metaphor here, but it's more than a metaphor, because actually the mathematics and the complexity science and the critical state dynamics are the same. Imagine a mountain. You know, I always think of the Wyball back at Aspen Highlands for skiers who are familiar with that. But a mountain where an enormous amount of snow has built up, and it's very unstable, and there's avalanche potential. But the avalanche hasn't started yet. It's just sitting there. But you know that potential is there, and you know there can be an avalanche at any time. Now, a snowflake comes along and hits and disturbs a few other snowflakes, and that slides, and that disturbs more, and it loosens more, and turns into a snow slide, and then a chute, and then all of a sudden it gathers momentum, and the whole mountainside falls loose, and the avalanche comes and buries the village. Now, in that dynamic, what's important? Is it the snowflake or is it the instability of the mountainside? I would say it's the instability of the mountainside. In other words, if it wasn't one snowflake, it could have been the one before or the one after. If you have an unstable system, eventually something will cause it to go critical and collapse. The something doesn't really matter because you only, first of all, you'll never see it coming. Secondly, you only know after the fact. And three, it doesn't matter. What matters is the thing collapsed. When a nuclear bomb explodes, does anyone, you know, look at the neutron generator and say, oh, gee, was that neutron over there? It doesn't matter. What happened is you destroyed a city and killed several hundred thousand people. What you care about is the critical state dynamics and the explosion, not the particular neutron that caused it. So I don't worry about the neutron. I don't worry about the snowflake. What I worry about is the instability of the system, because if you have an unstable system, it's just a matter of time. So thinking about, oh, gee, well, this speech or this failure or this bankruptcy or this, you know, act of Congress cause it, you'll never know. It doesn't matter. What matters is, do you have an unstable system? And the answer to that is, yes, we do.
I would recommend everyone read the book and look at some of the ideas you have relating to inflation being used as a policy lever, rearranging social and economic relations. There's a number of things in the book that I think are very, very intriguing. But as we wrap up, maybe you can look at this. If we were to return to a gold standard, how do you arrive at a price for the metal? I mean, the argument in the mainstream media is that there simply is not enough gold. Therefore, there's liquidity issues that would plague the system, and it just wouldn't work. What does that look like?
Well, that is a standard objection to a gold standard, and that's complete nonsense, because there's always enough gold. It's just a question of price. In other words, is there enough gold at $1,200 an ounce? No. But there's plenty of gold at $12,000 an ounce. I'm not necessarily predicting $12,000 gold, but what I'm saying is there's always enough gold to support the international monetary system, to support trade and finance. You just have to get the price right. And this was the great blunder of the 1920s. You know, prior to World War I, there was a very successful, what's called the classical gold standard. The United States, at least, did not have a central bank prior to 1913. So we had a growing economy, great innovation, great technology, expanding world trade from 1835 to 1913, and had no central bank. There was no Fed. But we had a gold standard, and it worked very well. Now, that gold standard was abandoned and suddenly in 1914 because of World War I, and the countries knew they needed to print money to fight World War I. Once World War I was over, and you're now in the 1920s, the major trading financial partners, you know, France, England, Belgium, others, wanted to go back to the gold standard. But it raised the question, what should the price of gold be under the new gold standard? And France looked at that question and said, well, you know, we printed an enormous amount of money to fight World War I. We cannot possibly go back to the old price. We have to have a much higher price so that the parity between gold and the money supply reflects the reality of a new higher money supply. So France devalued the franc, and at least in French franc terms, you have a much higher price for gold. Now, Great Britain did the opposite. They looked at the same problem. This was actually Winston Churchill's decision. He said, well, we want to go back to the old parity, the old pre-World War I price of gold, which is, you know, in dollar terms is about $20 an ounce. And to do that, however, they had doubled the money supply. So if you had an old parity and you doubled the money supply and you want to go back to parity, you either have to double the price of gold or cut the money supply in half. So England said, we want to go back to the old price. That meant they had to cut the money supply in half, which was extremely deflationary and depressionary, and gave them an overvalued currency and contributed to the Great Depression. So with that as a sort of history lesson, now move forward into a future potential gold standard. One of the most important things that they're going to have to do, whether this is done by the G20 or the IMF, they're going to have to get the price of gold right. And it's really eighth grade math. You just look at the money supply. Just divide the amount of gold by the money supply, and that gives you a price per ounce. And there are some technical questions there. You know, when you say money supply, do you mean M0, M1, or M2? You've got to answer that because they're all different. And when you say backed by gold, you know, what percentage backing? 100%, 40%, 20%? You can debate all those, and they're all different. But given those variables, given those inputs, and I've done this math, the indicative price of gold is, you know, at the low end, $3,000 an ounce. And at the high end, $45,000 an ounce, depending on who's in the club, what countries participate, what definition of money you use, what backing you use, et cetera. I expect the gold will be $7,000 an ounce. That's kind of the middle of the road, but that's the non-deflationary price of gold based on current quantities of gold and current money supplies to support world trade without deflation. So that's not going to happen tomorrow, but if you do go back to the gold standard and you want to avoid the mistake of the 1920s, you're going to have to get the price right. And the indicative price, based on all the information we have, is about $7,000 an ounce.
You know, this is very different than Rubini suggesting that we're going to 1,000 or other quote-unquote experts who would say, clearly the trajectory of the dollar is higher, therefore gold lower. I guess what you're really saying is that the half-life of the dollar is accelerating to the downside, even if we see something of a rally here in the dollar, or as you say, if you treat gold as the constant, that's really not where we're seeing volatility. It's just in the currency. Am I correct in saying that you do see the dollar going lower over the next several years, or maybe just hitting the wall at some point?
Well, put it this way. The Fed wants a lower dollar. Now, they're not getting it right now. The dollar's actually getting stronger. That's because they've made noise about withdrawing policy and interest rates have gone up. So the U.S. capital markets have suddenly become more attractive. So money's falling out of emerging markets into the U.S. market, and that's putting a floor under the dollar, making it stronger. But that's not what the Fed wants. The Fed wants a cheaper dollar to import inflation to drive nominal GDP, as we explained earlier. So therefore, if they want something and they're not getting it, what are they going to do to get it? And the answer is keep printing money. So I think over time they'll get there, but it doesn't mean they get there right away.
Now you've got the Fed and the PBOC saying the same thing. We're going to tighten. The markets don't like it. Who wins in this conflict between tightening, the suggestion of easing up on current monetary policy, and what the Fed has conditioned the market to expect, easy money and lots of it?
Well, I think the central banks are going to have to back off because when they understand the implications of what they're doing, when they stare into the abyss, they're going to lose their nerve, which is exactly what they did in 2008.
Jim, thanks for joining us. Would suggest that any of our readers, not suggest, I would insist that any of our listeners read your book, Currency Wars, primer on the past conflicts that we've experienced and real work of anticipation as well. Things that are in real time from the capital market perspective occurring and risks that have to be addressed, either from portfolio management or just appreciating the change in the nature of culture and our participation in it. Thank you for your contribution, Jim. I hope this isn't, I know it was your first book, but I certainly hope it's not your last.
Thanks, David.
David, something that Jim said that I think is so absolutely important to understanding the markets right now is that they're not sending clear signals. Price discovery is so important in being able to make correct decisions. And right now, when you're in a period of time where no market is sending a correct signal, including the gold and silver market, sometimes you have to step aside into what a person says is the stable money that you don't, when you're not playing the game, you're in gold. When you're playing the game, you're in currency, you're in stocks, you're in bonds, what have you. Doesn't that make sense right now? No matter what the gold price does, if you want to step aside, be in gold.
Well, absolutely. And I think one of the things that is important, again, just to emphasize how imperative it is that the book gets read and is studied by our listeners. You know, there's so many things that he talks about, whether it's time frames, looking at a slack economy where, you know, less developed countries will see an immediate impact to monetary policy, whereas more developed countries, you can put in place monetary policy and you don't see the inflationary impact for some time because there is slack in that economy. You know, there's those issues. There's the issues of capital controls, both in terms of defending hot money capital flows coming in, as well as the notion that people need to diversify geographically and have money outside of an area where you're talking about currency collapse occurring. One of the things that he highlights is that it's oftentimes the case that you have an increase in asset values in the context, the early stages of an inflation, and no one considers the inflation to be of any real concern because all they're looking at is being knee-deep in clover, not realizing that they're on the cusp of being knee-deep in something else.
Well, and I think his point about the Federal Reserve testing the water a little bit here by talking about tapering, it just is not going to work. These guys are so stuck in this system at this point. The Federal Reserve is so necessary that they're going to have to continue to print. And he even named all the different names that they call it, you know, from monetization all the way to quantitative easing. You know, they can call it what they want to call it, but it's still the creation of more money.
Kevin, you recall the conversation we had with Giulio Garrodi, and his emphasis was on, we will not go back to a gold standard per se, but we will go back to something with the characteristics and disciplines of the gold standard.
Right.
I think for Mr. Garrodi, what he's considering is current circumstances in which the establishment is not particularly open to a gold standard because of the disciplines that it brings into the system.
But with a context change, like you were talking about.
And that is what I think Jim Rickards is considering. considering is you're dealing with a radically different environment altogether. You're dealing with a collapse in confidence, and in that environment, the only thing that restores confidence, historically and future tense, is the role that gold plays in that monetary system. Jim's not alone in this. There's a growing number of Wall Street and hedge fund experts that would say this is an inevitability. Now, what exactly is the time frame?
Yeah, time frame. So when does that final snowflake cause the trigger of the avalanche?
The time frame is really up for grabs. And I think this is where experts in the field would say 0 to 3 years is one scenario. And in that 0 to 3 year period, it could be tomorrow or sometime in the next 36 months that we see a 30 or 40 or 50% decline in the value of the dollar. The other camp would say, I think as Jim has put his flag in that camp, maybe it's 3 to 5 years, nothing immediate. These things do take time. It is the Mark Twain notion of how did you go bankrupt slowly and then all at once? How did the currency collapse? Well, it was almost imperceptible, and then it was overnight. And that's his notion, I think, 3 to 5 years, where we do have some time to play for. Let's be thankful for that time. Let's get our house in order. And by all means, don't neglect the read and study of Currency Wars by Jim Rickards.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, James Rickards. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.